and welcome to Illinois Tops Times second podcast. I'm your host, Greg Hupker. Our goal with these podcasts is to help provide coaches and athletes with resources that can help them be their very best. And today's edition will certainly provide that. Today I get an amazing opportunity to hear from one of the greatest sprints and hurdle coaches in the country, Vince Anderson. If you happen to not know Coach Anderson, he serves as the hurdles and women's sprints coach at Texas A&M. His entire resume and accomplishments would fill our allotted time, so let me provide you with a few brief highlights. He's had 32 years of collegiate coaching experience, and he's now in his 13th year at Texas A&M. He's assisted in 9 NCAA Outdoor National Championship titles and 2 NCAA Indoor National Championships. His teams have the collegiate records in the 4x1, 4x2, and shuttle hurdle relays, and he's coached numerous All-Americans and national champions. And, Coach, congratulations on your recent national championships, and thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. Our team was really poised for that, and they did a wonderful job. Thank you for the chance to share some comments and insights with the Illinois coaching community, who I dearly love. And so just looking forward to this occasion. Illinois is a devoted track and field state with a great tradition, and I'm glad to be a part of that. So thank you very much.
Awesome. And Coach, can I say one of the things that I was most impressed with is your awesome perspective. As I was preparing to do this, I was reading your bio on the Texas A&M website, and you give credit to all of the coaches you've coached with, the mentors you've learned from. You give credit to your family, and I love the fact that in your bio you list your most proud of the academic influence on the life of your students, which has led to an exceptional graduation and personal achievement rate among his charges. I think that is fantastic, and as excited as we are to share your knowledge and wisdom with everybody, having that type of personal development philosophy, I think, is what coaching is all about. And I really admire that someone with your level of success has that perspective. I think that's awesome.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. As you know, that's easy to abandon at times. Some days you want to just throw chairs. You know, it seems like a much easier solution. But you try to tough that out and remember, you were taught to do things a particular way and try to hold to that. I had teachers, you know, who were really way more successful than myself. So I just try to emulate them. They had the patience to remember and stay calm and try to work it through. And that's what we're told to do in Sunday school. That's what we're told to do in school. So you have to apply the lessons that you've been taught in broader context, you know, even in coaching. Coaching doesn't have its own set of rules. Coaching is part of the rhythm of humanity, and you have to, honor larger truths when you're applying the very technical and specific things we do as coaches, you know, ballet coaches, algebra teachers, guys who, drive trucks for a living. You know, we all have to try to learn and listen and do things the proper way because we're taught how to do that. And so we just got to try to stick with it, you know, even when it's difficult. So sometimes I'm better at it than others, but, you know, we're obliged to try to do that, you know, as a rule.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I know you've spoken with Coach Randy Anderson, who helps administrate and run the Top Times Meet, and that's about connecting collegiate or high school athletes with collegiate coaches and providing a championship experience. And he was really excited after talking with you some and coming down and watching your practices. He was hoping maybe you'd be willing to share some of your knowledge and wisdom about some of the following topics tonight. Some things like acceleration drills, maximum velocity, and then even your thoughts on doing race pace work right away, kind of in the training cycle, and he thinks those things that he's learned from you have been valuable in his training, and he spent some time in the high school coaching ranks and feels like that those are some areas where some high school coaches and athletes might be able to benefit from the amazing work that you've done at Texas A&M and how those things have played into some of that success. Would you be willing to share some of that with us?
Well, of course, I'll tell you everything that I know, and I think I'll start with you know, I'm occasionally asked what my philosophy is. And it's not a question I'm completely comfortable with, because the question assumes that, oh, well, you know, I'm a speed guy. You know, and someone else, it's okay to be a strength guy. And it's not philosophy. I've had really, really good teachers. I was a horrible coach. I was the worst coach on earth, easily. And our teams were getting their asses kicked. And I got tired of getting our asses kicked. So I tried to humble myself and said, I'm clearly doing something wrong. You know, what is it? So I started asking coaches who were successful what they were doing. And they were very generous with their knowledge, and they were very generous with what they shared. And they led me out of darkness, and they pointed me in certain directions. They told me to go to level one school, which was just starting. I was in the first level one class through USA Track and Field. I went to the first level two coaches class through USA Track and Field. And those things changed my life. Obviously, you know, the generous coaches who started helping me reshape the direction of my workouts, because I was a conditioning guy. I was like, well, you know, if you're just tough and you run the snot out of people and they're really hard and we're trying to get them in good shape, you know, that's the way to success. And it's absolutely not. In fact, you're doing really, really neuromuscular and physiological harm to a sprinter. You cannot train speed power athletes aerobically. It's not what to do. And this has all been scientifically proven. You know, the Soviets had 10,000 PhDs on a 14-year cross-sport study. The East Germans did a lot of work. You know, we know a lot more now than we did in 1945. Things change. New knowledge becomes available. So my philosophy, if you will, is to not violate the science. If something has been determined as scientifically proven, that argument is over. And I'm going to listen to those guys, that is people way smarter than track coaches, who figured all this stuff out, and I'm going to apply it to my training. So right off, you know, we know in the 100-meter and the 200-meter, there's a 0% aerobic component to those performances. 0%. So why would you spend 95% of your time on something that has nothing to do with the performance? And more so, not only is that a neutral, non-helping effect, it's actually detrimental, because, you know, the body has type 1 muscle fibers that are slow twitch. Everyone, God gives you a certain percentage of those. And depending on who you are, your fast twitch muscle fiber count is, you know, it's something you cannot genetically change. Everybody has type 2 muscle fibers, and those are your fast twitch muscles, and some are invested with a lot of those, and some an average amount, and some not so many. Okay. But thirdly, you have your type 2A muscle fibers, and those are essentially free agents, and they shape themselves chemically to respond to the training. So, for example, if you have a speed power athlete, what you want to do is train. You can't do anything about their type 1 muscle fibers and type 2 muscle fibers, as those are set. That's purely hereditary.
Yep.
But you don't want to shape their type 2A muscle fibers into slow twitch muscle fibers through the training regimen.
Yep.
So another way to say this is, speed creates endurance. Endurance in no way, shape, or form creates speed. And too many people invert those ideas. You know, if I can run 1,000 quarters, you know, in 60, I'm going to be a monster. No, you'd be far better off running one time 150 in 15.5. Like, that's a lot more effective than running 1,000 quarters, you know, which all that's doing is developing a slow movement pattern and turning type 2A muscle fibers, you know, into slow twitch muscle fibers. You're actually harming the athlete. The athlete actually would be better not doing that at all than doing the activity, which has a negative effect, you know, when it is the dominant mode of training. Now, is there a problem, you know, every, you know, month that you want to go out and run, you know, 12 times 200 meters, you know, that in and of itself is not damaging because that's one workout in the span of 6 weeks. So the density of that kind of training load and training pace and movement pattern is not enough to shape a movement stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're doing that stuff every day, which a lot of people do, that's the rhythm and posture and physiology you're creating within that speed power athlete, and it's very damaging. Endurance retards coordination, and endurance retards speed activity. Now, again, I didn't make this up. This is physiology. This is motor learning.
Mm-hmm.
So my philosophy is to not violate those edicts when I make choices.
Yeah.
So, with that idea, so, you know, how do you train a speed power athlete, you know, effectively? You know, well, obviously, there's a lot of free energy and momentum to be gained in an effective acceleration pattern. And no one knows how to accelerate. It has to be taught. I've been coaching 32 years, and I never have inherited an athlete, and I've had some wonderful athletes that I've recruited out of high school, and not one of them could accelerate or push by extending their back knee when they cleared their block. So I'm going to use the terms push and acceleration interchangeably. It's the same thing. Acceleration is pushing. Pushing is acceleration. Most athletes have the concept because they've been told all their life, you know, be quick, 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 be quick out of the blocks, stay low out of the blocks, you know, because they've heard that all their life without any, of course, verification or even pausing for a moment to think if it was true or not.
Mm-hmm.
They've just been told that. They sort of have an image in their head that their movement pattern tends to perpetuate, and because they all watch each other rather than watching the best practitioner. So track is a very strange sport that way. All the children that I know who want to know how to dance, they look at somebody who is an amazing dancer. They look at Michael Jackson, or they look at, you fill in the blank. They look at someone who can really, really move, and they copy their moves. Yes, you can watch TV. They see a move. They jump up off the couch. They try to emulate the move. They spot the move. They mark the move. They do it. Basketball. You know, we used to watch Gus Johnson's finger roll, and we sprinted out to the driveway and started to try to emulate it, you know. The same, you know, basketball moves, crossover dribbles. Kids see that. They try to emulate it exactly like the best practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to sprinting, you see Bolt, you see Lewis, you see films of the greats, yet you choose to emulate Susie on the block.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you choose dysfunctional models for something as important as sprinting? But yes, for basketball or dressing properly or putting on lipstick or a jump shot or a basketball move or a crossover dribble or a rip move if you're a defensive end, why, you know, all those people are following the best, so why wouldn't you do that for track?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't everybody copying Lewis? Why isn't everybody copying Bolt? Why doesn't everybody try to copy that or at least ask the question? Why does Bolt drag his toe? You know, why does Lewis keep his heels down? Why is Lewis not low out of the blocks? Why is Lewis not spinning out of the blocks? Why is Lewis not quick out of the blocks? Why is Bolt not quick out of the blocks? Why is that? They're the best. Because those questions normally follow every other activity in life. So why wouldn't they apply to track also? I don't get it. So this is a mystery to me. So track coaches have the unenviable task of being the only teachers in the world who have to tell their students, you know, do what Bolt does. Do what Lewis does. Rather than, you know, copying everyone else around you, because you don't do that in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to copy a jump shot, you're going to copy, someone with a really, really sweet stroke. You're going to copy Ray Allen. You're going to look at what Ray Allen does, and you're going to try to emulate him. So the ability to tap into kids' visual acuity and make them do what you want and change their movement patterns is a tough one, because as a track coach, you have to tell them the direct opposite of what they've heard all their life. So being a track coach in the United States, and I would suspect in other parts of the world too, I can't speak of how kids are in the UK or in, you know, Uganda or something, but I would suspect that the misconceptions about sprinting are just as prevalent there as they are here, but I don't know that. But I know in the U.S., the very ideas surrounding what it takes to sprint are just so, they're directly opposite of everything I was told as a kid. You know, stay low out of the block, stay quick out of the block. You got to be really, really strong and in really, really great shape to sprint. You know, dip your shoulder low into the turn. You know, hey, stride long. You're a long strider, man. That's awesome. Really stride out when you want to run fast. And all of those things, all of those old, tired mythologies and all those old, tired phrases, not only are they wrong, they're 180 degrees wrong. So if you actually violated those as oppositely as you could, you'd start being somewhat close to the kind of sprint coach, world-class sprint coach. You would start doing what world-class sprint coaches are doing in terms of training their people.
Mm-hmm.
So so acceleration. Acceleration is a skill. It's like batting or a jump shot or running a very effective deep pattern in football. It's not something you're born with. It's something you have to learn. So football coaches think nothing of telling their people, it's 2-a-days, it's August, it's hot, you can't put on pads yet, the state doesn't allow it, you have to start, you know, training in shorts. And on the very, very first day of football practice, when you're running team, you're running 7-on-7 or something, the wide receiver coach tells his wide receiver, beat your man deep for the long touchdown. First day of practice.
Yeah.
He doesn't say, don't you dare accelerate and get off the line. Don't you dare try to beat your man deep for the long touchdown because I don't want you to pull a hamstring. He doesn't say that. You know, batting practice, when baseball training starts in the fall, you get into the batting cage and you hit. You know, you hit the baseball. You know, in ballet class, the first day of training, you do some rudimentary moves that actually emulate positions you hit in ballet. Skill acquisition takes a very, very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to start very, 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 very early because it takes months and sometimes years to install, depending on the motor awareness of the person that you're teaching. Some learn faster than others, but in every case, fine motor skills and violent, intense, specific motor skills take a long time to acquire. So people are completely unaware of the fact that, well, it's a skill, so you have to start installing it early because I need that time, and if I don't take that time, it won't get installed because it takes a while to acquire. All other sports understand this, but track does not. So we don't start early because we're radicals or because it's some cute idea we came up with. It's because we know in terms of motor learning, if we're going to be sprinting well in June, we'd better start teaching them how to sprint on the first day of practice in September. And remember, we have the luxury of a very, very long lead-up. Like, we train 4 months before we run our first meet, or 3 months, we'll call it.
Yep.
Really, 4 before our first meet, because our December meet is the track equivalent of a scrimmage in basketball or football. Mm-hmm. But it takes a really, really long time. Now, so if you're a high school coach, you have less of a lead-up time to it. So you have to even find other ways, PE class, you know, activity class, you know, insist that your kids run in a club, Like, even if the state says you can't have track practice until January, you better be finding a way to get in some reps and get in some teaching before practice is allowed to start, you know, under your tutelage. You just have to do it. And, you know, even if it's 2 weeks, anything. But this idea that you wait to start installing acceleration or speed is wrong. Because you need both the intensity, because of the speed power levels of speed power athletes need the training loads need to be, the training intensities need to be very, very high, you know, to train speed power athletes. So slow 200, slow 400s, doing, you know, a lot of slow generic running is not meeting any of those needs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's physiological. And the other thing, too, you know, it's a commonly held saw in our profession, you know, don't peak too soon. The most prevalent training idea within the community of coaches in the United States is don't peak too soon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been coaching for 33 years, and I've never seen an athlete peak too soon. I've not seen it once. So, logically, I look around and I go, wait a minute, this isn't a problem. It's not an issue. Like, I've never known one athlete to peak too soon. You know, so why do we make a completely unsubstantiated concern or a completely unsubstantiated fear the main regulating principle of our training program? It's insanity. Plus, we now know that because the East Germans basically did extensive studies on this, and essentially, by the way, I'm liberating everybody now. There is no such thing as a peak, so don't worry about it. The problem in our country isn't that people are peaking too soon and failing to run fast when it's time. That's not a problem. The problem in our country is too many people aren't peaking at all, ever. Because I promise you, if you try to avoid a peak, you will absolutely be effective in that pursuit. You will ensure that a peak is never attained. So we're going to make damn sure that we know what our people can do. We're going to make damn certain of that.
Yeah.
Now, if someone were to counter and say, "Well, I know Joe ran, you know, 21.6, you know, at you know, a month before state, and you know, he couldn't, you know, and then he got hurt and didn't do well at state." You have to prove to me, through training or other easily documented steps, that he didn't break up with his girlfriend, or he didn't have, you know, he wasn't out late partying one night that induced the injury, or he wasn't getting his rest and diet, which created a problem. That failure, you would have to be able to attribute to a specific training deficiency, specifically that you started everything too early. But you can't do that. That's never the case. When those kind of things happen, a kid usually isn't taking care of their body. A kid usually isn't listening to the coach. You know, a coach is you know, perhaps, you know, the whole training plan is ineffective. His ineffectiveness at the state meet wasn't because he peaked too soon. The problem was an ineffective training plan to begin with. Or it was a litany of problems that could happen off the track. He wasn't hydrated or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that, you know, that you attribute every single person who failed to run when they were supposed to run because they peaked too soon is pure insanity. Get real. Look at it a little clearer and a little deeper with a little bit more adult viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out what the problem is and remove yourself and liberate yourself from this ridiculous constraint. We don't want to peak, but we don't want to peak our people too soon. I have never had a problem peaking my people too soon. I have only had a problem of trying to get them to peak, period. And I start on day one.
I love it.
So, no, that's where it's at.
Yeah.
So, like, listen, you know, listen to the right drummer, not the wrong drummer. So, if you're going to regulate your training around some idea, make sure that that idea is scientific, has a scientific stamp of approval.
Mm-hmm.
So, coach, you're full of hot air. How do I do that? Well, the easiest way is to go to the USA Track Coaches Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a totally science-based curriculum. And it's fantastic. So if you want to get your mind blown and get in the right lane for what you got to do and how to organize training, because there's a way to organize training, go to the USA Coaches Academy. If you can't go to the USA Coaches Academy through USTF, CCCCA, then, go to level one school at USATF or level two school, which are reasonable substitutes. I don't think they're as good, simply because the people who wrote the curriculum initially for USA Coaches Level 1 and Level 2 basically took their curriculum with them to USTF CCCA. So this is not about personality. It's just about a curriculum that I'm very fond of and I think is very responsible.
Yep.
So do I endorse that curriculum? Yes, absolutely. It's wonderful. Any person who wants to know how to train speed power athletes should take that and not only take it, but go with the idea to change their tune, go with the idea of actually applying the principles that are taught there, because, again, it's nobody's opinion. We're just telling you what the science is, and the science dictates certain things. So, for example, if you want to crush your guys with a heavy lactate workout on Monday and then come out of blocks on Tuesday, or do 4x1 handoffs on Tuesday. That's a relatively ineffective regimen.
Mm-hmm.
Turned around, if you did the block starts on Monday or the 4x1 starts on Monday, and then crushed them with lactate on Tuesday. While crushing them with lactate, you can do at selected times. You don't want to overdo it. That shouldn't be your main modus operandi. But if you were to do that, that's a much more effective order, because then at least the speed development and activity that you did on Monday is going to take, because they were relatively fresh, their body was relatively ready to neuromuscularly receive the work, and if they're swimming in lactate after Monday's workout and you try to do that on Tuesday, not only are they moving very well, but the work isn't taking because the body is swimming in lactate, and lactate shock retards coordination and learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
the sequencing is everything, and you go to school and you learn how to sequence things, not only in the week, but in the year. And mm-hmm. So getting back to this idea, so not only are we getting to specific activity early, we're also honoring that idea, speed power precedes any aerobic or, I'll use the term conditioning activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the least important thing you do in the week for the speed power athlete. So if you must throw in that kind of thing, and we all have to throw in a little of it, that's mm-hmm. the key word, a little of it, not a lot, a little of it, that goes at the end of the week, not at the front. So, again, I didn't make any of this stuff up, but I'm up because I do care, and I do mm-hmm. want to be a good coach. I listen to it, I heed it, and I don't violate the science.
Yep.
Do I violate the science sometimes? Yeah, sure, everyone does. No one's perfect. But here's the thing. This is what Coach Seagraves used to say. Know the science. Know the rules. And if you do have occasion to violate the rules, know damn well why. Have a reason for doing it specifically. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there is a specific reason to violate the science because of particular circumstances. Understand when you're violating the science that that's not to be done very often, and that if you do it, have a darn good practical reason for not doing it the way it should be done on that occasion.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And so as I mean, I really hope that some coaches get a chance to listen to this, because starting from the right philosophy is so critically important, you know, and knowing, getting themselves the opportunity to learn the science, whether it's a, you know, USTFCCCA Academy, which I agree are fantastic. I was fortunate enough to do some USATF level one and level two, where I got to hear from Boo, who's just a great educator, and I know that our Professional Coaches Association has done a great job of not only getting great curriculum together, but getting great educators to teach it so coaches can understand it. And so for coaches to understand, to start with the philosophy, know the science, know what happens, you know, and the sequencing of things, how important that is. But like maybe helping bring it back to a level some coaches can understand if they don't have all of that background, maybe continuing, if you can, talking about some of those acceleration drills and how they can teach that skill a little bit to some of their athletes. Because like you said, some of these coaches are going to have a great opportunity to take a 14-year-old kid, and then maybe they're not going to have them as captive as long as they would like, but start teaching that skill to them when they're 14. So you don't have to do all the work when they're 18 and learned it wrong for 4 years, that they can help even some people like you down the road, too.
Sure. I'll be happy to share that. And the other thing, too, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an effete, you know, academic at all. I'm a basic, you know, I'm more of a physical education kind of background person. I was an architect in college, but you know, my attention was grabbed by physical education kind of activities when I was in high school and when I first formed my ideas of wanting to be a coach. So the final thing, I just want to say this one more thing. So I'm not talking about heavy science. I'm not talking about an engineering curriculum. I'm talking about science life. So nobody has to be like an intent. Don't think that you have to be, you know, an intellectual or great at science in school. You just have to care enough about track and about sprinting and about speed power training to where you don't shut your ears and keep doing the same thing that we've been doing since World War II.
Yep.
And you turn it around a little bit and you start being a modern coach. So you know, don't be part of the, you know, there's a whole new world now. You wouldn't buy a phone the same way you did 30 years ago. You can't train athletes the way you would 30 years ago because we now know, you know, technology and stuff changes. So the coaching academies will give you a very light science. They'll tell you why you can't do certain things in a very simple, understandable way that makes sense, and then you can go about your business. So it's not heavy science. It's very light, weekend warrior kind of science, that mainly has to do with track, and that's what we all love, and that's what we all do. So don't be daunted by the idea of science. So, all right. So
they don't need to know the Krebs cycle. They did give them the practical principles of speed power training and biomechanics and things that they'll need to help structure a sound program.
Yeah, have them jump and sprint and bound and throw a lot. Don't run the snot out of them every day.
Yeah,
you know, that's essentially it reduced in three sentences. So don't train them like a miler. Don't even try. Don't even think that's wrong to do. So we digress. So acceleration. Okay, so because you get so much from acceleration really creates a lot of free energy. And I would say people who push hard from the blocks, you know, in the 100, you know, it's like running a 90. If you push hard from the block and keep pushing in the 200, it's like running a 180. If you don't push and you spin out, it's like running a 110 or a 210. And I'd much rather bring the pushing hard from the pedals for an extended period of time. If you push the whole way until you become vertical and then keep pushing, it'll actually bring the finish line closer to you. People think, my God, if I push hard, I'm going to run out of energy. Wrong. The opposite is true. You gain energy. It's easier. So people who don't push and just start running or spinning or they're low out of the blocks, quick out of the blocks, that's excruciating because you hit your top end sooner. You therefore expend your three allotted seconds of max velocity sooner and are left with much larger stretches of track to cover
in a state of deceleration, hence making it agonizing. So what you want to do is push, and keep pushing. All Bolt does is push himself all the way up the track, and that's all Lewis does. There is no such thing as the drive phase. The entire race is the drive phase. So we hate the term drive phase. It's okay to talk about among coaches, but I can't stand talking about it with athletes, because every athlete who uses the phrase is either trying to tell you how much they know about the sprint, or the other problem with it is everyone who uses the term assigns a number to it. One guy, it's 12. One girl, it's 18. Somebody, it's 24. And they're not pushing an inch past that spot, which is ludicrous. The entire race, Bolt pushes for 101 meters. Lewis pushes for 101 meters. The entire race is the drive phase. You know, there isn't really, I mean, among scientists, there's something called the drive phase because it has to do with body length. But all Bolt and Lewis are doing is pushing the entire way. They push for 100 meters. So that's the simplest way to explain it. So you can't push too hard and you can't push too long. And ideally you want to do both. Push as hard as you can for as long as you can past 100. That's the easiest way to explain it. That's such a simple directive. Like, that requires no understanding. Like, you know, it's very, very simple. So the best thing you can do there is begin to teach them how to get in a responsible set position. You know, everybody when they in a responsible on your marks position. And people are notoriously bad at this because they've never been told how to do it. That's where you get the person kneeling down and their front knee is in their throat, what I call the knee in the throat on your marks position. You know, the front shin, of course, is parallel to the ground. And you keep pushing that front foot back until the front shin is parallel to the ground. And then the back knee is about 6 inches in front of the front foot. And then the hands are directly below the shoulders. The shoulders are directly above the hands. And it doesn't matter if you're 4 feet tall or 6 foot six, that those are body proportionate cues. And you have to learn to address. So on the first day at track, we address all our athletes without blocks. We teach them how to proportionally put their body relative to some starting point, you know, say a stone line or whatever. You know, get your front knee out of your throat. You know, quit taking your back knee all the way to the other side of the track. You know, most people have to bring their front foot back, and most people have to bring their back foot forward, you know, to get into these proper alignments. But just feeling something simple like that, it's a physical education activity, just like you teach them in health class. You teach them personal hygiene. You have to teach them blocks hygiene or on your marks hygiene so that effectively now they can get into a set position. If you're on the marks position, it's healthy and right and hygienic. You can get in the right set position. But if you're on your marks position, it's not correct. You have no hope of getting in a good set position, a three-point stance, a four-point stance. Anyway, you have to teach this on the first day, because that teaching will pay you back each and every day of your training. That's where training begins. Once you do that, you teach them how to come to set very quickly. It takes about 5 minutes. Rise until your front knee is at 90 degrees, not less than 90, not more than 90. You feel your front knee at 90, that's where you lock in. And you push off both legs and you post your shoulders up. And, you know, you can show them video of this, you can show them film of this or whatever. But right on the first day, we have them do this. No blocks, they're in their flats. And we do something like two sets of 10, 20, 30. You do a 10, a 20, and a 30. Rest a little bit, go 10, 20, 30. So on the first day, we've got six accelerations in, two 10s, two 20s, two 30s. They have a rudimentary idea of how to get to their marks, have a rudimentary idea how to get to set. We get right to it, just like music teachers get right to it. My son went to a guitar class, and he was strumming chords and playing songs the first day. He'd never picked up a guitar before. So why do we wait? Like, quit waiting on this stuff and get right to it. Now, there's a modicum of correctness. It can't be just, you know, free-for-all. But with some instruction and some reasonable physical education teaching, there can be a reasonable adherence to good posture and good body positions. And then you go from there.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So that's on the first day of practice. Okay, so then after we've done 10, 20, 30, we go into the grass and we run 6 times 50 meters at 400-meter pace. So, however, you know, so 52-second quarter milers are running, you know, 13-second pace for the 100 for 15 meters. Yep. Now, they can't run, you know, 52 seconds on the first day of practice for a quarter, but they can sure as heck run 50 meters at that pace. And so that's what we're going to do. And we're going to run 50 meters, and we're going to rest a minute, and we're going to come back. And then we're going to rest 2 minutes. And then we're going to repeat that two more times. So that's 6 times 50 meters, 400-meter pace, trying to emulate the push-outs we just did. Because remember, we just did 6 accelerations, and we're teaching them you have to push and extend the back knee and lock it out. And we're trying to carry that over. So the teaching begins on the first day. And tempo work we're doing is relevant. It has to do with someplace we're going. So in your tempo work, is it taking you someplace that you're going? Like if you a 60-second quarter miler, again using your example, why would you ever train at 38-second pace? You're never going to go there. Why would you train there? Why would you spend time on it? What does a 38-second tempo have to do with a 60-second quarter miler? It doesn't. So you have to start this idea that you start so far away. Take these incremental, tiny little, slow build-up steps to finally get to race pace is insanity. We'd much rather start with rhythms and postures that are relevant on the first day of training and live there for a long time and, in fact, get better and learn to be comfortable at them.
That seems to make a lot of sense to me.
So, anyway, that's kind of how we approach it. So acceleration is a big part of this. Max velocity, we'll practice that the second day. And we have we put up little 6-inch hurdles because athletes don't want to step on things. So the way you teach them, nearly all athletes I've ever had, in fact, all athletes I've ever had, overstride because they've been praised for it for their entire life, and striding is such a wonderful thing, in the culture of sprinting. But we won't even allow the word to be spoken at our track because striding is horrible. And what people think of as striding, this is the thing that I resent so much as a track coach. My athletes, it's very hard to get them to do anything right and to listen right, okay? But athletes know exactly what striding means. And every coach in the United States, when they tell their athletes to go do some strides or do some striders or go stride, athletes execute that directive perfectly every time. Every athlete says, I knew what striding meant, and when my coach told me to do it, I did it great. And striding is the sworn enemy of sprinting or running. So never tell your athletes to stride anything. Never use it as a verb or a directive. Because if you do, they will give you precisely what you ask for every time. And it has no resemblance to or relation to sprinting. In fact, it destroys sprinting at its root. So you can never stride anything. We do acceleration. We do max velocity runs. We do runs at certain tempos where the posture is perfect and the athletes are stepping down from above. We never stride out. We never stride. It's not permitted. If I see it, I shut them down. I send them home. So the culture of striding is something that has to be eliminated with extreme prejudice from any self-respecting sprint program if you're going to succeed at what you do. So we explain it to them. We don't expect them to know that because striding has been enabled their entire life. So then they come to our program and we have to explain to them that striding is, we're not going to do it. And it's not permitted. Don't use the word. I never use the word. Get it out of your vocabulary. Get it out of your consciousness. Because everything associated with strides and striding is directly opposed to what we're trying to accomplish here. Now, if that offends you, that's okay. You can go somewhere else where striding is allowed, but it's not allowed here. It's no part of what we do ever, and it cannot be. I didn't make the rules, but I will enforce the rules that much smarter people than me made.
I love it.
So that's kind of, you know, and you have to have that talk to explain, you know. So anyway, so we do max velocity drills to eliminate overstriding. And so you put little six-inch hurdles, and I have the top of the six-inch hurdles laid down on the ground. So they're really only just marking a spot, you know, and athletes don't want to step on things. So I don't have the hurdles up. They're not really stepping over the hurdles because I put the rail down. But at program distances, obviously different distances for different level of athletes. But on the second day of practice, once we put our little six-inch hurdles down, we call them wickets because they look like croquet wickets. After we put the wickets down, we choreograph a six-step run-in to the wicket. And then we expect them to hit every piece of tape on the run-in because that sets them up perfectly. And then they run through the wickets as fast as they can. And I would say that because the spacing on the wickets is progressive, when they start out, they're at a sub-maximal intensity, something like, you know, 50, 60%, but the frequency is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And we go out to, you know, 18 strides on this. So on the very first day, you know, we'll do it at 14 strides, and then if they get it, we'll go 16 strides. And then immediately, again, that rapid progression. That first day, we're running over 18 strides. And by the time they're out at 18 strides, I would say, 18 divides nicely into 3-3 and into 6-6 and 6, you know, nice even thirds. The last third of that run, they cannot go any faster. So even on the second day of practice, we do six of these. You have a 5 or 6 meter segment in each rep where they're at max velocity. Now, we're not at max velocity for 150 meters or 120 meters or 80 meters, but for 6 meters, and we've built up very smoothly to it, they can't go any faster. So we're starting to develop postures and tempos on the first day of practice. And, of course, we don't tell them, don't do that because you'll pull a hamstring. Because, of course, they won't. They're athletes. You know, the basketball coach never tells his guy, don't you dare elevate and dunk over somebody on the first day of practice. I don't want you to hurt yourself. You never hear those words. And you don't in football either. So quit impeding your people with that idea. Speed does not cause injury. Injury is caused by 3/4 of the time lack of hydration. It can also be caused by hitting a bad posture, i.e. overstriding. Overstriding can cause injury. You know, or coming back too soon from a pre-existing injury. Running fast doesn't cause injury at all.
The other 22 hours of the day that we don't have them and they didn't take care of their body.
Correct. You know, but quit attributing, you know, injury to speed work. You know, let's say I ran speed work every day in max velocity. My athletes would get hurt, but the mechanism of that is this. What happens is they're depleting all of their energy stores and the muscles are becoming tired and inflamed and it becomes an overuse issue. It's not the speed that did it, and that's bad planning in your training. That's a bad coach right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in football, teams that I like to attribute sprinting, max velocity work in track and field. I like to liken it unto hitting in football. The teams that don't hit at all, like Hal Mumme's team, famously, they can't tackle. There's never been a team that doesn't hit that can tackle. Okay, so that's not the answer.
Mm.
You know, famously, you know, people who hit too much and overdo it, I'm using football coach language now, quote unquote, don't have any legs for the game or have too many injuries to have all their best players on the field. But that's not good coaching. That's overuse syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
The best teams, however, hit each other with extreme prejudice, hit each other hard in the mouth, just the right amount through the year and through the week. And they're the ones that win. So speed work is the same way. If you think that that you're saving injury by not running your people, that's a falsehood. What you're doing is you're making sure that your people don't succeed because you're not giving them what they need. It's not specific to the performance. And good training accounts for specificity of performance. So you better be doing some maximal velocity stuff and better be coming out of the blocks hard, you know, at some point fairly frequently, because that's a skill to be acquired, not a skill to be avoided.
Coach, could I ask you a question? Like, with your acceleration drills and also with your wicked drills, you've talked about it before. You do this, like, twice a week, right? It's not something you do once a week.
I do acceleration, yes. I do acceleration as the featured activity twice a week, and I do the max velocity, the wicked drill, as an auxiliary activity 2 to 3 times a week before either we do some really specific speed work or really specific speed development work, or before we do tempo work. See, ingeniously, we're not going to stride before we do tempo work. We're going to sprint and sprint great. We're going to sprint full speed before we do any tempo, because that ensures that day I've gotten some speed development in. We're good and warmed up. It's always a great idea to warm up way faster than you're going to run. That's sort of a golden rule. Do not warm up to the tempo you're going to be running. You warm up to a full sprint, and then you run whatever tempo you need.
And is the acceleration and the maximum velocity drills you do you do them throughout your season all the way?
Yes, we start on the first day of practice. So if we do two to three max velocity drills per week, we never stop, and we train for 42 weeks, we're doing somewhere between 800 and 1,200. Reps a year. So of that one drill, and we start early, and we get better and better and better, and our capacities increase. And the spacing gets wider and wider and wider. Acceleration, same thing. We'll early in the year, and I'm staying away from this because it's a little complicated to talk about, but we have tape spacings we put for our tape drill, which marks certain acceleration capabilities. The further you put the spacing apart, the faster the athlete is to be able to achieve it. And by the way, people, acceleration patterns don't have anything to do with athlete stature. That is, tall people don't have long strides. Fast people have long strides. So, I had 2'11 flat athletes. One was, Angela Williams at USC. I didn't coach her, but she ran 11 flat in the 100, and she was about 5 feet tall. And then my decathlete, Chris Helwick at Tennessee, was 6'6". And he ran about 11 flat in the 100. So my 6'6 decathlete and Angela Williams had the same footprints in 100 meters. So in other words, all 11 flat people are basically stepping in the same footprint, essentially. So don't think tall athletes have long strides. Fast athletes have long strides. All 1080 people have about the same stride length. All 10 flat people have about the same stride length. You know, there's some nuance in there, but the stride length doesn't have to do with their stature. It has to do with their velocity. You have to make sure you understand that. So my point is, so when we're putting these marks out, we'll do something like, I have a bunch of pretty good female sprinters, so we're going to maybe try to hit an 11.6 or an 11.7 tape spacing on the first day. And then, you know, by this time of year, you know, we're trying to hit maybe an 11.40 tape spacing. Mm-hmm. You know, that grows and morphs as adaptation occurs, and that's something we can see, athletes consistently getting over the marks. They're on top of what we call on top of the run. And when they're on top of the run or over the run consistently, we now know that we're ready to take on maybe a new spacing and expand that tape out a little bit. Did right. that answer your question, or did I digress?
You did a great job answering the question. The one thing, my experience right now, and this is going on wicked drills, okay, is that we got to a certain level, and then we went to nationals and then gave them a break and came back, and they look terrible again. Obviously, I had too much of a break, right? I mean, we got to stay on all
the
time.
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I've seen the opposite happen, by the way, that's an interesting motor learning phenomenon. I've seen people, like, for example, come back after a summer break, and their first practice of the fall was sharper than ever. so, because there is some kind of residual learning going on at the cellular level. So that may have just been, you can be rusty after a little bit of layoff, particularly if it's a new skill. And sometime I think you'll find it goes the other way as well, interestingly enough. That when you plunge into something hard and you really do it intensely and then you get out of it a little bit and then go back into it, sometime that accelerates learning. Motor learning seems to be accelerated a little bit by an ins and outs form of training. Now, when it comes to acceleration and max velocity, we do it all year, all the way through. Obviously, there's a break at Christmas. You know, and I think the variety we're providing within that context, you know, on the acceleration is most of the time that's the main featured element of the workout, but occasionally it's auxiliary. On the max velocity drill, or the wicket drill as we call it, that's very rarely the main element. It's usually an auxiliary element that supports or completes something else. So I think for that reason, because the distances are growing and that's something we're monitoring throughout the year, that we're keeping the stimulation in those drills, even though they're all year, because we're gradually progressing them as we see fit.
And you also feel strongly that teaching them to accelerate and also maximum velocity, both of those are equal value and you have to focus on both of them, correct?
Yeah, yes, and I have a very simple reason for saying that. In 100 meters, both of those are accounted for in the performance very heavily. It's not one or the other, it's both, and one blends into the other. So you can't neglect one at the expense of another, because it would be like, you know, that they're both equal, you know, they're both endemic to success in the event. So how can you choose one above the other?
You can't. I understand.
So both have to be visited and visited frequently, because those are, see, that's the thing. When I make my training decisions, I'm heavily, heavily, heavily invested in things that relate to performance. And I'm heavily, heavily, heavily divested from things that look nothing like the performance. So if it doesn't look like the performance, I'm not very interested in it. And, I mean, that's not, again, I stay away from absolutes. That's not absolutely true, but it's 98% true. I'm
yep.
heavily invested in things that relate to performance, and I'm heavily divested from things that have nothing to do with performance. So if it doesn't look like the performance that I'm looking for, I have very little interest in training that activity.
Yep. If it looks like a duck and sounds like a duck, it's probably a duck. And if
yeah,
you're not looking for if you're looking for a goose, don't be making it look like a duck. So you gotta
yeah.
keep things very specific. One of the things that I thought real quickly when you're talking about the stride patterns of an 11-second 100-meter runner, and when you're talking about the wicket drills and you're taping those stride patterns down so those athletes learn that, you know, it's like their map to success. Like
correct.
If you're learning to do the waltz, they might put the footsteps down, you know,
yep.
those, and so they learn to do that. It's like that because
yeah.
you might have a 10:90 runner, but they're stepping like an 11-second runner, and you're going to get an 11-second runner because they haven't learned to run like a 10:90 runner.
Correct. That happens. Both of those scenarios happen all the time.
Yeah. Well, Coach, we want to be really conscious of the time. We've kept you for a long time, and you've given some great information. And I know, you know, you have had great success, you know, in the hurdles as well. One of the coaches, there are a couple questions I think people might find interesting to get your thoughts on. Is what are some of your thoughts on sleds or parachutes or some of those type of tools for
okay.
sprinters?
Yeah. I like sleds. Most people overload them. You know, the sled itself is usually enough, or maybe a 10-pound weight, you know, is enough. It just needs a little bit of stimulation. So I don't like it when people bend at the waist and become a plow horse, because then their shoulder displacement and their leaning is what's doing the work. What you want to do is you don't want to deviate from sprint posture. So you just want a little stimulation. Harness them up, pull a sled, that's cool. But they should post up and keep rising as they move away from the start line. So
you know, that just needs a little bit of stimulation, but a little bit of neuromuscular stimulation. You don't need to load someone down. It's not how much they... Now, if you want to load it a little bit more and their posture's still good, you're probably in the range of being okay. But when they start bending at the waist and taking their shoulders down and becoming a plow horse, now, again, we're getting into territory that doesn't look anything like the performance, and so I'm not interested in that at all, because then all we're doing is training bad posture and unsupportive ideas. We want to support ideas that support the race pattern, and that is shoulders posted up and keep rising. Lewis posts up his shoulders and keeps rising. Bolt posts up his shoulders and keeps rising. Maurice Green posts his shoulders up and keeps rising. Now, it's like a Saturday Night Live skit, you know. Maurice Green famously says, "I stay down in my drive phase." But, of course, he doesn't. He rises with each step. So we like to say, you know, do as Maurice does, not as Maurice says. You know, people say, "Well, you jerk! How do you know what he does?" Well, because I've watched hundreds and hundreds of videos of it. He doesn't stay down in his drive phase. He rises as he pushes, like all good sprinters do. So he's got it right. He's just describing it wrong.
Yep.
Sprinters should never try to stay down in their drive phase. You should rise as you drive, smoothly like butter. That's why Bolt and Lewis.
Yep.
You know, Coach Telez never talked about transition. You know, Coach Telez never talked about the max velocity phase. And all sprinters is here, you know, where you have a drive phase, you have a transition phase, you have a max velocity phase, you have a maintenance phase, you have a deceleration phase. All those things exist in the scientific community, in the measurement community, but they don't exist to sprinters. Sprinters hear that stuff, and they run the 100, and it looks like five things stitched together. It looks like, and when you see Bolt and Lewis run, it's, it's one thing. It's butter. That's because they just push the whole way. So there's a way you can kind of cut through all of these seeming complexities. You know, and it really is all good 100 people. We all agree on this. It's something you can see. It's something you can quantify. All great 100-meter runners, it looks like one thing. It's not five things stitched together in phases.
Track is really kind of, track and field are really kind of hampered by bad vocabulary that has persisted for a number of years, and the connotation that some people place with it, the athletes, they just need to unlearn.
God, that's beautifully stated. I love the way you said that. I've never heard it put that way, and you're dead on, and that's right. And if, with your permission, I'm going to use that. So to everyone participating in, like, and that's where going to school, if nothing else, helps. It helps you use responsible vocabulary. It actually pays you back and works toward the goal you're working toward rather than against it. And what great coaches learn how to do, and so my evolution of a coach, and I've got a long way to go, but my evolution as a coach, I'm consciously aware of never coaching against myself. I coach against myself less and less and less as the years go by, and it really, really helps.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so if nothing else, going to coaching school and learning how to apply some of these ideas and get your vocabulary straight where it's not at odds with what you're wanting or what you're communicating, just that alone would immeasurably change anyone's coaching life. It has certainly changed mine.
Yeah.
So that was beautifully stated. I agree. That's the punchline of this whole thing.
Do you mind if we ask you a couple questions about hurdles and then?
No, please do. I'm having fun. So.
Oh no! I mean, this is amazing. I mean, we are so thankful and feel blessed that you're willing to spend this time with us.
It's cool.
there's a million things that hurdlers can do to improve technique. The things that we've talked about, I hope coaches understand too, with the maximum velocity acceleration drills, those are as critically important for sprinters. You got to know how to, or hurdlers, you got to know how to sprint, you know, before you can hurdle.
Yeah.
But what are some of your favorite hurdle drills?
Well, we don't do that many hurdle drills. I like a stationary wall drill where they just put the hurdle 2 feet from a wall and they lean against the wall at the lowest setting, and they drive their they turn their lead leg out and drive the knee up and then swing the whole leg through. It teaches, mm-hmm. you know, the trail leg rotation has to be toe out, knee up, thigh through, in that order. Now, you can do that as fast as possible, but the sequence may not be encumbered. And most people do encumber that. Most people don't turn their toe out first. Most people bring the knee through first. They don't turn the toe out and bring the knee up before they do that. They bring the knee through first, and then they try to turn the knee out and up. And that's where you get that weird-looking thing that looks like they're actually retreating from the hurdle and coming back around again. So, you know, you have to get that sequence. And they can do, you know, 10 of those on each leg every night. I like a six-step drill, six-step approach drill. I'm using that a lot now, where the women start with their hands at 9 meters 20 from the first hurdle, and the men start at 9 meters 80 from the first hurdle. That's the start line, and they go as hard as they can for six strides, and I mark the six stride pattern out. Of course, you know, again, choreographing the steps. Now, all along, of course, they've had a good indoctrination, a 4 to 5 week period where all they're doing is sprinting at the beginning of the year. So this vocabulary of acceleration and pushing has been established. Mm-hmm. Because hurdlers, as you said, need to run fast. So we don't hurdle until week 5 or week 6. I think that would be critical for someone who's new to your program and needs to learn the language and that kind of thing. For maybe a second year kid or someone who already knows a little bit about acceleration, you can start them hurdling earlier than that. But certainly mm-hmm. for a novice, I'd invest a month or 5 weeks into teaching you how to set their blocks, how to sprint, how to push, all those things, because you need it. Now, that said, so you have a six-step approach to the first hurdle, 980 for men, 930 for women, or 920, 930 or 920 for women. Then the hurdles are set basically for women at 750, 7 meters 50.
Mm-hmm.
And increasing 15 centimeters after that, so 750, 765, 780, and 795 from a six-step approach. And you go as hard and aggressive as you can from that distance. Because remember, it's not a full approach. It's a three-quarter approach. It's six steps instead of eight. And for the men, the spacing is about, let me think about this, I don't know, I'm used to feet and inches. So the men is, let's see, not 914, but about 815, 830, 845, and 860, same drill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do something like this. I'll go over low hurdles, 30-inch hurdles for women, twice at that distance, and 39-inch hurdles for men. In your case, for high schoolers, it could be 36 or 33, mm-hmm. any height. It doesn't matter. You want to get the rhythm. And then after they do that twice, I move the hurdle up one notch to the next highest height, and we do the same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a nice drill, and that really is a great drill to do before you do the, you know, maximal hurdling from 8 strides or whatever. That really kind of gets them ready and establishes hurdle rhythm. So I like to use a lot of reduced distance, and you can take the flights out about as long as you want. Once you get out to about to that fourth distance, you know, you wouldn't increase the hurdling distance any further, you know, so you stick out to that last distance, 795 for women and 860 for men. Maybe they kind of stay there. Anything you do after the fourth hurdle, but you can get a lot of traction out of that activity. So those are my two favorite ones.
Okay.
And we spend a lot of time hurdling, you know, at three-step distance at reduced distances, like, you know, either each hurdle in 30 centimeters or more, depending on we'll put them in more than that if we want to get a better cadence. Like if the
we're very shameless about reducing the distance of our hurdles if we're not getting the rhythm that we want. You know, so for someone trying to run 14 flat, you want to average about 110 per hurdle unit. So if, if you go over six hurdles, obviously that's five units. So if someone hurdles 550, that's, you know, if you can take every unit if you want, but I like to sometimes do it quick, first hurdle, last hurdle, and divide. If someone goes over six hurdles, that's five units at 550, that's 110 per hurdle, that's 14 flat takes. And, you know, you can occasionally monitor their runs to see how they're doing, because the judgment you then have to make as a coach is, do I need to move these, am I good where I am, and are we getting what we want, or do I need to move these units in a little tighter and try to get a better tempo?
Mm-hmm.
And that has a lot to do with the hurdler themselves. If I've got a 14.2 hurdler and they're at 14 flat pace in practice, I'm delighted. I'm giddy. You know, so I'm going to keep rolling with it. But if I've got a 14.2 hurdler who's at 14.2, you know, I might move each hurdle in another 5 centimeters or something, you know, just to try to get that little extra. So, you know, I will do what I have to do to get the rhythm I want on that day.
Yeah. How many, like for a high school coach, how many days a week would you encourage them to be thinking about doing?
I would say, again, 2 days where they're training just like a sprinter, so maybe that's one acceleration day and one speed development / tempo day. And then two other days they're hurdling. So, and one of those days they're hurdling against each other competitively. Like, mm-hmm. i.e. doing block starts against each other. And the other day they're doing long flights over speed hurdles like I just described, flights over 8, 10, 10, 8, or something like that at this time of year. We start that sequence. It's something like doing 6 hurdles, 8 hurdles, 8 hurdles, 6 hurdles. But then we grow to, you know, before long, you know, 8, 10, 12, 10, like over the weeks. Like, we just mm-hmm. keep progressing that 4 reps of speed hurdles, each flight getting longer as they stabilize and show improvement. Like today we have an early week this week. Our competition starts earlier than it usually does. So this is like a Wednesday, even though it's a Tuesday. So today we didn't do 8, 10, 10, 8. We did 8, 10, 8 because I wanted to slightly shorten the workout because this is like a Wednesday where they're competing on a Friday, you know. So I had to roll the week back a little bit.
Yeah, uh-huh. So like, if a high school coach...
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
One of those reasons, you look at your circumstances and you have a reason for doing what you're doing.
Right, right. So if a high school coach, maybe you're not the head coach and you're the hurdles coach and you have 2 meets in the week, your hurdle day is those meet days. And you find a way to incorporate possibly some of these additional drills, you know, that are part of the warm-up or that you can do
Correct.
Outside of the races. And then, you know, you spend your time recovering or doing your acceleration drills on the days that you have between to make sure that your sprinter knows how to sprint. One of the things that I was thinking as you're talking about, you know, the spacing and making sure that they can hit the frequency that they need to be a, you know, a 14.2 hurdler or whatever. What are your thoughts on, say, a young hurdler? Because everybody hears how they need to three-step, but if three-stepping is going to make them look like they're not sprinting any longer, do you think it's the end of the world if they're four-stepping until they can learn to reach those hurdles in the rhythm that they need to?
No, I don't, because obviously you have to do what you can do, but here's what I do object to.
Okay.
Even when they're four-stepping, they're training at three steps. Like, maybe they can only get to a hurdle, you know, a girl 750 and a boy 850. But, I mean, they are flying through, like, you've got plastic green hurdles up there, and half their reps are three steps. And I mean good ones. And then here's what you do when the coach stabilizes and see, Susie is looking pretty good at 750. Joe is looking pretty good at 850. Coach takes them out to 765 and out to 865. And then, you know, he's still doing his four-step thing. You know, he's doing some reps at four-step. He's doing some reps at three-step. You stunt their growth by not three-stepping them. So the three-stepping must be aggressively pursued with extreme awareness and prejudice as they go through the year, and eventually they will not be four steppers anymore. Where they die on the vine and get bad, as people think, well, they just can't make it, they're a four stepper. Well, so what's going to change that?
Yeah, I love it.
You let them go to the meet and run 4 steps, but you train the snot out of them at 3. And you see where they're good, and you're always pushing that edge, and when they stabilize, you push them out a little bit more and claim a little bit more ground. It's just like geopolitics. You know, you take a little bit of Poland first, you know, and Poland doesn't complain too much. So then you go take a little more of Poland. I mean, that's how World War II gets started.
Coach, I love it. I know, I think you have a meeting, and we've probably kept you way too long. I know Coach Randy Anderson and myself, we could listen to you forever. I love what the information that you've shared and your willingness to do so. And I know, you know, just from reading your bio and listening to you, I shouldn't say no, but I can sense that you're appreciative of the knowledge and wisdom other people have shared and that they've Amen. Spoken into your life. And, you know, Coach Randy Anderson, I feel really strongly that everyone benefits if this knowledge is disseminated, so we can, like we talked about, if we could ever get track and field to stick to a vocabulary that was neuromuscularly and physiologically and biomechanically sound, that we obviously have the athletes that are talented enough to produce, you know, the best athletes in the world every year. And working with athletes, there are more important things than that, but that's available to the United States if we could have a aggressive and consistent philosophy and vocabulary to help educate these young people.
Yes, sir. I couldn't agree more. Beautifully said. Thanks for having me on. And I really do, like, the reason I'm so anxious to share is this stuff works beautifully for anybody. Like, there's nothing magic about that. Like, it works the same for all people. So if you, like, you apply it, it will make a difference in your coaching as it has made a difference in mine. So I'm just a living testimonial. That's all I am. I'm just a signpost going, yeah, man, we can all do it. Like, you know, if I can do it, anybody can, because I was lost. And, you know, I'm not as lost anymore. So that's good. People help. People brought me out of darkness. So,
Coach Anderson, I just want to take a moment to thank you for your help this year. I wanted to tell you that we had a softball player come to the track program this year that's never ran ever. The worst mechanics in the world. We put her in the wicked drills, and at the end of the season, she ran a 780. And we had a lot of improvements this year because of your wicked drills, and just want to thank you for sharing that, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us tonight.
Well, Coach, let me correct you on one thing. They had a lot of improvements this year because they have a good coach. The wicked drill does nothing. It has to be taught in the classroom. Bam, there you go. So right on.
Well, thank you again, Coach.
Thank you so much. Okay.